XXX is brought to you by Smith & Noble, offering custom window treatments, including blinds, shutters, shades, and panels, without the custom price. For a limited time, get 25% off your window coverings, plus a free in-home consultation when you visit smithandnoble.com/XXX or call 1-800-659-3300. And by MeUndies. MeUndies makes the world's most comfortable underwear in a variety of styles and patterns. Head to MeUndies.com/XXX to get free shipping and 20% off your first order. And by BowlAndBranch.com, offering luxury bedding at affordable prices. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers and more at bowlandbranch.com. That's BOLLANDBRANCH.com and use the promo code XXX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XXX Gabfest for Thursday, May 4th, the Kotex and My Bugatti edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia, and I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So, Noreen, I have to thank you for how I spend this week, which was just watching The Girlfriend Experience.
And do you feel like you've had a girlfriend? How do you feel about it?
No, oh my God, she would be the worst girlfriend ever. But I don't think I've inhaled a show in a really long time like that. And I can't exactly say why I like it. I haven't really digested it yet. But
it's like a mood more than anything.
Exactly. I said on the Culture Gabfest a couple of weeks ago that it evokes a feeling in me in a way that rarely happens on television. The last time I can remember is The Bridge. That just kind of gave me, like, there was almost like a sensation of sympathy with it, like we were on the same wavelength or something. And even though I don't have anything in common with pretty much anybody on that
June,
show.
Are you a sex worker?
I might just do an occasional girlfriend experience.
You are a high class escort? I didn't know that.
Sure.
Well, let's move into our topics, because I'm hoping in our first topic, we will actually talk a little bit about The Girlfriend Experience, and maybe you guys can help me understand it in the cultural context, because our first topic is sex workers. It seems now that the movement to decriminalize, I guess we don't call it prostitution now, we call it sex work, that's the correct term, is gaining steam, and we're going to talk to Emily Bazelon, who has a story about this in this week's New York Times Magazine. Second, we're going to talk about Melania. There's been two great profiles of Melania this week, the mysterious Slovenian with the psychedelic eyes, who might or might not be our first lady. And finally, we're going to talk about Drake, the rapper who millennial men are obsessed with. Why? What does he represent? And our first ever Slate Plus. XXX Gabfest is joining the Slate team of plussers that I said completely wrong. And we're going to try and do a trope, is this sexist? And just answer that question about various things happening in the culture. And our first one is going to be, is the opposition to Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill sexist? So tune in for that. Let's start with our first topic, sex workers. Except in a handful of enlightened countries, there's always been strong resistance to decriminalizing sex work, and much of that resistance has come from feminists. And now that seems to be changing, at least a little. We talked to Emily Bazelon, who has a great story in the upcoming New York Times Sunday Magazine about this topic. Hi, Emily.
Hey, guys. So nice to be with you.
So, Emily, the term sex work, where does it come from? Why do we call it sex work now?
The term sex work comes from the 1970s from a feminist named Carol Lee, who's still alive and well. I was just emailing with her the other day. And the idea was to think of the crime of prostitution as not a crime and as a form of labor. And just to come up, I think, also with a term that was more respectful of people doing sex work, because in English, the word prostitution is a kind of demeaning word, right? It's sort of, we talk about someone prostituting herself or himself in other contexts too, is a kind of debasing thing to do. And so in the 70s, one group of feminists who called themselves sex positivists rejected the idea that sex work was necessarily a source of disempowering women. They were thinking of this as like a choice that some women could make, and so they wanted it to be recognized as a form of labor.
Can you explain another term that comes up in your piece, which is abolitionists?
Yeah, sure. So this is like slightly later. dated term, more like 80s, 90s. And now we're talking about another group of feminists who I think most of us are more familiar with. We're starting with Andrea Dworkin in particular. Catherine MacKinnon comes in here too. Sometimes these feminists are called radical feminists. And the idea of abolitionism was to deliberately invoke the image of ending slavery and to apply it to ending demand for prostitution. So this is the opposite of the sex positivist view. This is the idea that prostitution is inherently demeaning and a source of sexism and violence against women. And so we need to abolish it, end demand for it, and that it's appropriate to think of it as akin to slavery.
And what's changed now? Like, this debate has been going on for a while. It's been going on for the 70s and long before the 70s. So why is it now that we're suddenly hearing, oh, there might be an actual movement to, I don't know if decriminalize sex work or just change the cultural ideas around sex work? And we talked at the top of the show about the girlfriend experience. Like, there just seems to be new thinking about sex work and whether it's legit.
Yeah, what's changed in the last, like, say, 10 years, maybe 15 years, is a kind of different pragmatic way of thinking about the legal issues surrounding sex work or prostitution. You can pick your term. And it really starts with the battle against HIV and AIDS. So, you know, sex work can be a way in which HIV and AIDS are transmitted. And public health groups, as a result, started trying to work with groups of sex workers who were organizing to distribute condoms and educate their peers and men about the importance of using condoms. And it turned out that some of these sex worker groups were really good at this work. And that created a kind of international alliance with groups like the World Health Organization and some of the work of the Gates Foundation in places like India, other developing countries, and the UN, UNAIDS in particular. And so what you see there is a kind of non-ideological support for the idea of decriminalizing what the public health folks also call sex work as a way of making people safer and just as like a public health model, because if you bring a practice up from underground, it's just easier for people to get health care. It's easier to make sure that there are good, safe practices going on. And then the sort of last part
of it was totally practical. Like, it was just a practical idea. Let's enlist them.
Not like really interested in this feminist battle and not thinking about the morality or immorality of what people are doing. Just like, okay, how do we save the most people from dying of AIDS? And then the last piece of the puzzle is the human rights community. So in the last few years, Human Rights Watch and now Amnesty International have really tried to study this issue, gone around the world, talked to lots of people who are currently doing sex work, who stopped and consider themselves survivors, lots of different groups, and studied the sort of practical ramifications, thinking again about HIV and AIDS, but also about the problem of trafficking. And both Human Rights Watch and now Amnesty have concluded that decriminalizing sex work is the better human rights practice. And that is a very controversial stance. Amnesty got just like a ton of criticism from, you know, abolitionists, from other people who just opposed this idea when it started talking about recommending decriminalization last summer.
Well, you know, Emily, I have to say, having read your piece, which does a remarkably good job of representing the different points of view, it's really hard to not sympathize with the decriminalization point of view because, as you say, from a health point of view, in terms of saving lives, in terms of just being generally safe, from just a criminal point of view, it makes it, if things are not underground, it's easier, for example, to make sure or to be able to report illegalities, to report harassment or abuse or trafficking or all of those things which are the problems rather than the sex work itself. And so it just feels to me as if even by being extremely objective, you have very effectively made the case for decriminalization. Do you want to push back on that?
Not really. No, because I tend to also be a pragmatist. And so I see the appeal in everything you're saying. I mean, look, I guess, you know, the other side of this is this question of sexual inequality and where it comes from and whether most of the prostitution or sex work that occurs in the world kind of feeds men's ideas about dominating women. I just feel kind of agnostic about that.
Mm-hmm. Wait, Emily, can you explain that to me? Because it seems like one thing that decriminalizing sex work does is give women agency over their job, right? Like it cuts out the pimp a little bit, or is that not how it ends up working practically?
Well, that's a really good question. And now you're talking about like these different legal models. So in some of the countries that have legalized prostitution, meaning like it's legal but it's heavily regulated, it has not worked out very well in terms of taking power away from pimps. So Germany, for example, as far as I can tell, is a place where big criminal enterprises, including people we probably would call pimps, still have a fair amount of control over what's going on. A country that seems to be a contrast to that is New Zealand, where, yes, some women work in Brussels. The Brussels are still managed, but there also tends to be a lot of, like, women working for themselves in that country. And that also happens to be true of India, a place where there are probably millions of sex workers, and it's not exactly decriminalized, but sometimes there's a kind of on-the-ground detente between the police and the sex workers. I don't want to make it sound like everything's great in India. There are also, like, terrible abuses going on there and trafficking, but it's this very mixed picture in a way that I had no idea about and found sort of surprising. So it really depends where you are.
Wait, but to stop you there, like the Uberization of sex work hasn't worked out great. I mean, we've heard a lot about, you know, sex workers operating independently on websites getting murdered. So there's also that.
Where has that happened?
The Robert Kolker book, you know, the
people Lost Girls.
Lost Girls. Like there is a sense that, you know, I mean, this is, I'm really trying hard not to bring up the girlfriend experience immediately in this conversation. Because as Emily's saying, when you said there was no downside, June, you know what I immediately thought? I was like, well, but then the girlfriend experience would have no plot because the whole tension comes from the fact that people hold over her head the fact that what she's doing is illegal, you know,
right,
and that they're going to leak these pictures.
Then people wouldn't be able to blackmail her in that way,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Right. And I mean,
yeah.
Meg Munoz, who you quote at the top of your piece, you know, she said the empowered sex worker isn't representative of the majority of sex workers. I mean, it is important to remember that, you know, maybe because of who we are and who we know, we have a certain view of sex work. And it might be more the girlfriend experience or, you know, the somebody who has a website or who uses apps or whatever. But that there are many different kinds of sex workers and some of them are people who would be exploited, whatever it is they do. And it's their, you know, among their few options. One of the things that I find really interesting, though, is you mentioned that, you know, 2/3 approximately of people who are arrested in the U.S. For prostitution or, you know, sex work related crimes are women. And I wondered, of the other third, how many are John's slash customers and how many are male sex workers? Do you have a sense of that?
I don't, because you can't pick it up from the federal statistics.
Gotcha.
But I will tell you about the statistics in New York, which are that many more women get arrested for engaging in prostitution than men for patronizing a prostitute. So that's the Johns. Mm-hmm. It's like 3,200 women over the last couple of years, and I want to say like 1,400 men. I will also tell you that of those men, 93% are men of color.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that only men of color are patronizing prostitutes. It means that the police are, you know, are making arrests on the street in places where the Johns are men of color, as opposed to going after, you know, white people who might be more powerful. It's also almost heavily women of color who get arrested. And the number of people being arrested for promoting prostitution or sex trafficking is far lower in New York City. So this is really, you know, a kind of criminalization that for the most part, it looks like, picks up, you know, people committing pretty low-level misdemeanor offenses, but who then have criminal records to deal with.
Exactly. And if, once you have that criminal record, there are so many things you can't do, not just, you know, what we typically think of getting jobs, but even training to, for example, become a dental assistant or a hairdresser. In many places, since you need a license and you can't get one if you have a criminal record, you're shut out of so many things. That's the kind of thing that I mean. But I'm also curious, you know, the reason I asked was a lot of men are also prostitutes, typically
yeah.
for men. And I wonder, you know, do when we think of sex work, do we simply kind of fall into stereotypes of women and poor women and kind of condescending stereotypes when and do we think differently when we think of men being sex workers, men being prostitutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do. And, you know, part of the reason I focused mostly on women was that I was looking at this feminist battle, and it tends to a little bit ignore men, male sex workers. But you're completely right. They exist. Their experiences don't really fit our stereotypes, and so we may think about them less. I did learn a lot about trans sex workers in working on this story, in talking to a number of them, and also reading a couple of very upsetting to me studies about how much employment discrimination trans people face and how much that is one of the reasons that they are entering sex work. So they're more at risk of arrest. They're disproportionately represented among sex workers. And that was a kind of alarming part of the story for me.
Emily, do you have any sense that this is going to be one of these issues where there is a quick generational sea change in the United States, that, you know, younger people seem more open to decriminalization than perhaps previous generations did?
I think that younger people probably are more open. I also think that a huge change in the criminal law throughout the United States seems very far off to me. We have some of the harshest laws against prostitution in the world, and the idea that that is going to suddenly flip seems unlikely, especially because in cities like New York and Seattle that are relatively progressive, what they're trying right now is not full decriminalization by any means. It's a shift in Seattle toward arresting men, and in New York, it's a shift toward human trafficking intervention courts, which don't give people a criminal record if they follow through on the mandated counseling that a judge can order them to do. But, you know, their treatment, their kind of mandated treatment, and in that sense, they're coercive. And if you don't do what the judge is supposed to do, then you can still go to jail. So those are not the kind of decriminalization models that sex workers are asking for. And I don't see a place in the United States right now that's like on the cusp of trying this.
All right. Well, you know, some cultural change, not a lot of legal change yet. So that's what we think, right? Well, Emily, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you guys so much for having me and asking such great questions.
You should all read Emily Bazelon's piece, Should Prostitution Be a Crime? It goes online today in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, or you can read it in the magazine on Sunday. Now let's move on to our second topic, Melania. But before we do that, let's hear from our first sponsor.
The Double X Gabfest is brought to you this week by Smith & Noble. So, as we know, in New York City, probably more than anywhere else where you live, like, can really kind of soak into your bones. And when you look around your house and it's neat and beautiful, you just feel better about life. And when it's a little dumpy, you look outside your window and everything's a little grayer. And one very easy way to make sure that life feels better all the time is to have great looking window dressings. So as listeners know, I don't love my curtains. They are blue. They're not quite the right shade of blue. And I wish that I had given it a little more thought rather than just sort of scrolling through a bunch of web pages and clicking on whatever seemed, you know, the least obtrusive. Instead, what I could have done was gone to Smith & Noble for beautiful handcrafted blinds, drapes, shades, and shutters, which are actually custom made just for you. So you're not just, you know, looking around Pottery Barn and getting the same things that everyone else has. So create a space that you'll love and get started today. Contact Smith & Noble to get a special limited time offer for 25% off on your window treatments, plus free design consultation. For details about the special offer for the Double X listener, go to smithandnoble.com/doublex. That's smithandnoble.com/doublex or call 1-800-659-3300.
This week, there were two big substantive profiles of Melania Trump, one in GQ, one in The New Yorker, which told us a lot more about this woman who very well might be our next first lady. We learned, for example, that the two of them met at a party where Trump arrived with a different date, that she likes Trump just the way he is. He talks about her breasts a lot, and also that maybe she has a daddy complex, which I'm interested in talking about. Okay, what details stuck out to you the most? Like, what impression? Let's just say in the GQ story, she talked to the author, so we did get a little bit of a sense of how she talks and how she thinks, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot.
The thing that struck me was something that I guess Julia Yoffe quoted from a Donald Trump appearance on the Howard Stern show, which is that she has never farted or done duty in front of him.
That was amazing. That was amazing. She said, like, the key to a happy marriage is different bathrooms. Yeah. It actually kind of gave me a sense of why evangelicals and conservatives, there's something so traditional and old-fashioned about the way she conceives of husband-wifely relations, which pinned her as a certain type.
Well, and also pins Donald Trump as a certain type. That he's been married 3 times, mm-hmm. and the one that didn't stick was with an American. Yeah. Let's just say it. Like, he has, you know, had this long marriage to Ivana that seemed to be a partnership, a real partnership in many ways, and now this long marriage to Melania that is also a partnership in other ways. And he just seemed, there's some kind of Eastern Bloc approach that he has to his marriages, which is, it doubles back around and becomes kind of a heartland, you know, old fashioned thing.
Yeah, I mean, here's another great one. Julia Ioffe, who writes about Russia a lot, I feel got at that Slovenian gestalt, you know, mm-hmm. that way of being very well. She said, he's a very understanding husband, she once told an interviewer. If I say I need an hour, I'm going to take a bath or I'm having a massage, he doesn't have anything against it. He's very supportive. Like, really? Like, what's the, you can't have an hour to take a bath? Like, that's her definition of supportive. So I think she has a pretty, like, she knows how to be a wife. Also that they have no nanny. Is that true?
The New Yorker piece contends that Donald has actually admitted that there's someone who, quote, works with Barron. So I suspect that they do have a nanny, but it probably is a point of pride for her that she spends a lot of time with Barron.
It was really striking. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys watched the CNN town hall that was with the Trump family. And so it was all of his kids except Barron, his older kids and Melania. And just the way that they spoke was fascinating. And Melania kept repeating that she spends all of her time with Barron, that she's raising him, that she's showing him morals and values. And she said that several times, morals and values, morals and values. Hmm. And, you know, that another striking thing is that so Lauren Collins in The New Yorker said that she's a model with the past of a nun. I mean, that she, like Donald Trump, doesn't drink at all, that she, even when she was a model and she was living in these, you know, exciting fashion cities, she would go to bed early. She had her focus was on, you know, advancing somehow. And I guess we're supposed to sort of connect the dots and say, and so, you know, bagging this husband was the advancement that she made. Maybe that was her goal. I mean, that seems extraordinarily cynical on my part to even say that. But, you know, maybe she was just maintaining her looks because that was her profession.
I wonder if we are all being too hard on Melania, that she's an easy target.
Sure.
You know, she was a catalog model. She is married to Donald Trump. She says these things that can seem vacuous. But, you know, she didn't sign up for this. Mm-hmm. You know, Michelle Obama famously did not sign up for this and was sort of vocal about that, I guess, at certain points. But she wanted to be just like married to a rich guy and have this nice life. And all of a sudden, her husband's running for president and she's expected to be a political spouse. And are we being too cruel?
No, but that's every political spouse. I mean, no political spouse signed up for this. So we do this to every political spouse where we scrutinize them and then we wonder if it's okay to scrutinize them. I mean, the story in GQ is a perfect example of this. The outrage over the story in GQ was about the fact that Julia Ioffe uncovered something about Melania's father, that he had mm-hmm. a child that was somewhat unacknowledged, that hadn't been reported in the press before. And I think, you know, there's always a question of, with the First Lady, like, is there a line? Can you cross the line? Is she a fair target? You know, it always seems like the First Lady is just this vulnerable target who never asked to be where she is, and yet she's sort of fair game.
Yeah, but are liberals being a little cruel to Melania because she's, you know, first of all, she's Donald Trump's wife and we hate Donald Trump and feel like there's no thing that we can say that's too mean to him. But, you know, are we displaying our prejudice in sort of making fun of the fact that she's a model and she...
Are we making fun of it?
I think there are, yes, I think, I don't know that the three of us are, but I think the culture finds Melania very amusing.
Well, for one thing, you know, he said to Howard Stern, like, how do the breasts look?
Right.
You know, he's like ridiculous. You know,
he's horrible.
He allows us to make fun of her. For another thing, there is a genuine cultural divide here. When I interviewed my mother on Trumpcast, Slate's Trumpcast, about Donald Trump, because my mother's a Donald Trump supporter.
That was great, by the way.
Thank you. One thing that she said that surprised me, because I really tried to do a very straight interview, was that she fully perceives Donald Trump as an excellent family man, like who's surrounded by his children. And I asked her, and I don't think this made the cut, like, well, what about all those wives? And she was like, whatever, he's a rich man. Of course he has a lot of wives, but his children seem nice. He's always surrounded by his children. They're good people. You don't hear terrible things about his children. Look at his daughter who's pregnant. You know, he's got this other wife who really takes care of his kids. Like, I don't know if that's genuine or not, but there is something about Trump as old-fashioned family man. And even the way he wrote about Ivana, like in his book, he doesn't like those.
How did he write about Ivana? I don't know that.
It was like there's something that grates him about women who are too ambitious, you know, women like her who are too smart and too ambitious. He just doesn't want that in a woman. But I'm just saying there's something real here in his views in a divide about gender roles.
Well, you know what's really interesting about his family? There's a great Jonathan Van Meter profile of the kids, the Trump kids that ran in New York about 10 years ago that I reread recently. And he got a ton of access. And the basic takeaway of that profile is that Ivana raised the kids really pretty fully on her own. And then as they became adults, Donald became interested in them once they were sort of sentient beings. But really sort of all the morality and all that was instilled in them came from Ivana, because this was sort of around the time when he was, you know, stepping out on her with Marla Maples. And then it seems like that has been replicated in the Baron Melania branch of the family, that she really seems like the person. Her parents live here. They moved to Trump Towers from Slovenia. Baron speaks Slovenian at home. At one point, he went on, I forget which talk show, maybe Piers Morgan or something, and Baron had a Slovenian accent, which everyone found very jarring. But it seems like Trump is quite traditional in that he sort of leaves all of the child rearing to the wife, whoever she might be at that particular moment in time.
Yeah, and some people, that's like an America people want, mm-hmm. you know?
And yet there are these, you know, contradictions that he has railed against H-1B visas, and yet that's how Melania came into the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are visas that are for, you know, people with special qualifications. Most models don't have even high school, you know, they aren't even high school graduates, but models qualify because they are indeed especially, you know, they have special qualifications.
Endowed.
And so there's, you know, it's an opportunity to call hypocrisy, which is always a charge I'm never really all that excited about. But nevertheless, there it is.
Well, there was the best line in the Lauren Collins piece, maybe not the best line, one of many good lines, was she said that Donald Trump really should build a wall around his pants. Which is funny.
Do we want to talk about the hideous response to Julia Yaffe's? That was kind of stirred up by Melania.
Yeah, will you just explain what happened?
So after Julia Yaffe's piece appeared on GQ, Melania took to her Facebook page to complain about it. And she said that there were various inaccuracies, although she didn't specify any, although she talked a little bit about how her face cream had been misrepresented. And then, which really was the only thing that she went into any detail about. And this apparently brought down just a ton, you know, or it somehow turned on the Trump army to attack Julia Yaffe. And much of this happened on Twitter. And it was shockingly just raw, pure anti-Semitism, you know, Holocaust imagery. She got calls from casket companies and, you know, crime scene cleanup things. The phone rang, and when she picked it up, it was Hitler speeches. Just, you know, the kind of raw anti-Semitism that some of us prefer to think doesn't exist anymore. That was really shocking to me. And it also seemed like, okay, in this world, this is something that Trump could have stopped. This is something that is not in any way acceptable. It's over the line. And he could have done something just to, you know, call that off, and he did nothing. And that seems really appalling to me.
He always does nothing. It's like Cruz's father and the Kennedy assassination. I always think of it as like there's this kind of networks of pipes in the country, and kind of at the fringes there are these rusty pipes that like you know, that put out dirty, nasty water. And what the Trump but they're just kind of over there on the fringes. And what the Trump campaign has done is like hook up a main pipe to those little dripping pipes so that now they're kind of in the mainstream of the country, right? Like, surely those people would have said that anyway about that profile, but we wouldn't have known about it. It wouldn't have been channeled via the Trump campaign, you know? That's the worst part of his campaign, is that that kind of thing happens and then has a platform.
Can we go back? Can we?
To Melania.
Yeah, can yes. we? Well, can we just talk about her daddy issues, which I'm also interested in? I was quite taken by the photo of her father that appeared in GQ, which maybe it was the red tie and the blonde hair and the, how many years do they have between?
There's five years between Donald and Victor.
Yeah. Are we just being too armchair shrinky to see just clear cut?
I mean, I was torn about that. On the one hand, I was like, okay, this daddy issue psychobabble is delightful and pleasing and it's fun to read about. On the other hand, you know, could you take any, you know, Eastern blockish man of that generation and he would look vaguely like Donald Trump?
Well, maybe it's the generation thing.
Right. The 24 years difference. I mean, that's a rich guy thing, right?
Yeah.
It seems that they're quite well matched. I mean,
yeah.
She was always kind of acting like she had an old husband anyway, it seemed, you know, so.
Yeah. All right. Well, what do you guys think if Melania was her first? It's so hard to.
Well, she could be our first lady, you guys.
Who's the model for Melania? Is she like a, she's not a Michelle Obama. She's not a Hillary Clinton.
Is she a Laura Bush?
Well, no. You know, I was going to say that, and then I thought, well, that's sacrilege because Laura Bush is, you know, a substantive person, but Melania is a substantive person in a different world and of a different type. I mean, Laura just didn't say very much, and we always assumed there was a huge amount going on in her active little brain, you know, librarian brain.
Laura Bush is totally different. The great Laura Bush quote, I might mangle this a little bit. Someone asked, like, what do you do? And she said, I read and I smoke, which is like something out of a film noir, you know? Like, Laura Bush had a lot going on. And there's something rebellious about both of those things. I read and I smoke, right? Yeah. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of rebellion going on. Like, I think maybe she's a Nancy Reagan, although maybe she doesn't have the sort of steel spine of Nancy Reagan, but.
But we've seen no Nancy Reagan come out of her. Maybe it's in there, but we haven't seen it. Like the conniving puppeteer, like that doesn't seem like, I mean, maybe it's there.
I guess I mean like riding for the husband at all costs kind of Nancy Reagan vibe. Uh-huh. Maybe.
Yeah, I bet that's true.
I don't know. Maybe we need older analogies than this.
Lauren Collins pointed out that she would be the first foreign-born or first immigrant first lady since Louisa Adams.
Yeah, who was barely an immigrant.
Right.
I'm just going to read my favorite line from the Julia Ioffe piece, but she has such a dry way of unfolding a quote sometimes. And she asked her about, you know, what she was involved in as a first lady. And she said many, many charities. And then Julia writes, she elaborated, : many different charities involving children and many different diseases.
There are a lot of children and diseases needing help out there.
There are a lot of children with diseases, right. So clearly she doesn't know, and this is always the unfair thing. I mean, I wrote a kind of early unfair story about Jeb Bush's wife, and it's like they don't know, you know? With some of them, you really get the feeling like they weren't prepared and they don't know and they'll catch up, but it's going to take a while. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to need some handler to come and give her the proper charity and the right way to talk about that proper charity, and, you know, and then we can leave her alone and she can make her face cream. All right. So should we move on to our next topic?
Let's.
Okay. So we're going to talk about Drake. But before we do that, let's thank our next sponsor.
The XX Gabfest is also brought to you this week by MeUndies. You know, underwear tends to be something, unless it's a special kind of occasion, that you just throw on in the morning and you really don't think about it. And, you know, I have to say, I have noticed that sometimes grotty or boring underwear just kind of sets you up for a grotty and boring day. So that's why MeUndies is here to change that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal, a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free, no questions asked. MeUndies has dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. Shipping is free in the US and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair and get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/XX. That's MEUNDIES.com/XX for 20% off your first order.
All right, Drake. Drake has a new album out called Views, and there is a certain kind of dude, many dudes, who are obsessed with this album, who will dissect every track on the album. Is it tough Drake, soft Drake, petty Drake, bored Drake? There's like this special way that Drake turns on the millennial man. So we are going to dissect that because we're woman-splainers, right? So it's our turn to woman-splain about Drake. Mm-hmm. Doreen, I'm going to start with you. Like, when Drake has a new album out, what happens in your among your friends and your world of people?
Email chains. A lot of email chains. I think I'm not on a lot of them, but the dudes I am friends with sometimes loop me into their email chains about Drake. It's like the Super Bowl almost. It's just everyone gets really excited, wants to talk about it. To me, it's like in the way that men of a slightly different generation, although some men of my generation too, anything Bob Dylan does, they will endlessly analyze. Drake occupies that space for men in roughly my cohort. There's just something.
So it's like lyrics. It's like specifics of lyrics and what his pose is this time. Mm-hmm. I mean, Views is hard because every song, usually it's like, oh, this is, now he's in a tough phase. Now, Views is like all of the phases. So, you know, that you can go really, really deep in with this album.
Yeah.
Which song is what?
Yeah, there's like, I think there's also some identification with Drake that that maybe a lot of sort of, let's say, middle class to upper middle class white men did not necessarily feel with rappers of previous generations. I think it's easier. I mean, Drake is from a middle class household. He's half Jewish, which
kind of. I mean, well, I really want to talk about this identification because it is so different from how like white boys and girls of a certain age felt about rappers in my generation, which was like fascinated, but you're definitely outside it.
Yes.
You know, you're definitely outside it. It is just really different. So, okay, he's kind of working class, middle class. I mean, we can call him working class.
But then he was a child star. Like Drake, Jay-Z, like, you know, famously sold crack like well into his adulthood. Not well into his adulthood, but like Jay-Z is not from, you know, Jay-Z did not star on Degrassi, the Canadian like teen soap opera.
You got to leave me a little space here because this is all I know about Drake. I know him as Aubrey Graham, who was Jimmy on Degrassi. I can go into a lot of details on his plot line. I remember the day. I remember the episode where he was the victim of a school shooting and then did some amazing wheelchair stuff in the rest of his episodes.
That's the end of June's participation.
Thank you. Call me later.
But keep going. Like, he's from Canada. Have a bar mitzvah. Not only did he have a bar mitzvah, there's like a video of him dancing at his bar mitzvah, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's partly that, you know, white dudes or just like middle to upper middle class dudes of any race can see themselves more in Drake because, you know, just hip hop is just more generally culture than it was, you know, let's say 20 years ago. It's just the mainstream in a way that is kind of unremarkable now. But I think it's also, there is something specific to Drake, and I didn't use the Bob Dylan comparison. I didn't just toss it off because there's something about his lyrics that are like quote unquote sensitive. Actually, a guy once described Drake to me as like Joni Mitchell more than Bob Dylan because he's so introspective and like, or at least your earlier iterations of Drake. I think this is 2011 Drake that we were talking about, which is my favorite Drake.
No, it's like it comes in and out. I mean, that's the interesting thing about him. It comes in and out, his introspection and his paranoia and his, you know, he has so many different modes. I don't know what John Caramanica, is that how you pronounce it?
I think it's Caramanica.
Caramanica. Yeah, he had a great tweet once, which is Drake is all the emojis, which is true. Like, he just runs through all of them. And in Views, there's plenty. There's like sensitive songs and there's thug songs. You know, he has all kinds.
But all the emojis, not all the emotions, right? Because Drake is also this filtered, memed out, you know, yes. internet generation thing.
Yes.
Which is, you know, like, yes, he has these genuine emotions, but he also makes them kind of funny. So my favorite Drake song of recent memory was Hotline Bling, where he's singing about, you know, this girl who he dated when he lived in Chicago. Or lived in Toronto, but you know, she now, like, he sees her out all the time in the clubs. He just wants her to be nice, waiting at home, waiting for his call. And he dances around
like Melania,
like Melania, but he dances around in this sweater, this turtleneck sweater that became an internet meme. Like, so it's both earnest and like you can sort of make it into a slightly detached thing if you want to, which I think is very of this generation.
Yeah, I mean, the Drake and the internet is a whole long topic that we can talk about and how he rules it and manipulates it. And I think that's actually the thing that's most familiar about him, more than his sensitivity. It's just the way that he exists and lives online. But here's the thing about Hotline Bling I don't understand, and maybe one of our listeners can explain it to you, or maybe you can to me. Why is the video about... What is with the phone sex operators in the video? I like, what does that mean? The video is about phone sex operators.
It's a joke.
So, huh?
I think it's just
a joke. Is it a joke, or does it just constantly leave the sense? There's this Drake song called Marvin's Room, which I think contains all the Drakes. It's such an interesting song. It starts with this like fuzzy, he's drunk dialing, basically. Mm-hmm. He's drunk dialing, and like, and just like with Hotline Bling, like you get the sense like maybe he's just like making up his own narrative about this woman that is just like really far off base, you know? Like maybe Hotline Bling is about his relationship with a phone sex operator and not with a real girl in Toronto. Just like maybe Marvin's Room, the girl never relents. She's never like, oh, maybe we should get together. She's like, are you drunk? That's all she keeps saying. Are you drunk right now? And he's got this whole line about like she should be with him and the chump that she's with now. And she's just like, could you hang up my phone now? You know? So he like allows himself to be a chump in this way that makes you think like maybe he's like totally off base.
Yeah.
Know?
Lindsay Zolads, who used to work for New York Magazine and now works for The Ringer, the upcoming Bill Simmons site, had a funny Twitter post that then turned into a Facebook post where she argues that Drake has never actually had a girlfriend. Like he's definitely, you know, had a lot of sex, but never had a real adult relationship. And if you kind of listen to the lyrics, there's a real argument to be made. One of the sort of interesting things for me to watch is that Drake has evolved not in the way that you'd want a sensitive man to evolve, right? Like, you know, when he was 25, he was singing about these sort of, he hasn't moved on beyond the sort of 25 and hooking up stage in his lyrics, it seems like. You know, he's pining for these girls. But one of the lyrics on Views that like made the most waves is he sings about this girl who steals the keys to his Bugatti.
From the Cheesecake Factory.
This girl from the who he calls Hood in all kinds of different ways. She steals the keys to his Bugatti to go to CVS to get Kotex. And he's mad because she's putting miles on his car. And you're kind of like, man, like there are so many things wrong with that. But on the same album.
But hey, he's talking about, you know, menstruation.
Sure, he is. He definitely is. But he should have been going to get the Kotex for her.
Really? Okay.
It's true. He's kind of stuck in that phase. I never thought of that. Like, he's nostalgic for something that maybe he never had. I mean, if you think about how prolific he is, like, when would he have time to have a girlfriend? You know? Like, if you just dissect Views, as mm-hmm. many people have done, and you count the number of possible women he could be referring to, like, how is that possible? It'd be like a full-time job, like, hooking up and breaking up with these, like, girlfriends that he's nostalgic for.
Yeah, which is why I find it upsetting that so many dudes I know, like, you know, look up to Drake. Not look up. I don't find it upsetting. I understand it. It makes sense. He is sort of an aspirational figure who's reacting in the exact same ways that they might react in such a situation. And he has, I mean, they're like...
Or at least he wants you to believe that.
Right,
like, in these songs, he's like half that person, half just some dude who's, you know, drunk dialing some woman. And he's also Drake. Like, at the end of Marvin's Room, he talks about being Drake and, like, how he can't handle his fame and all that stuff. So it's like he toggles back and forth between being, like, basically maybe, like, right now the biggest male you know, rap pop star there is. He's like Rihanna level famous, mm-hmm. and also just being like the dude at home drunk dialing and talking about the Kotex. Like, he's both those people.
Right. You know?
We should also say that his album Views sold 600,000 copies on iTunes in one day. So, yeah, he's doing all right.
Yeah.
Don't you think that one of the reasons that we do project so much on Drake is that he's Canadian and we Americans have ideas about Canadians? Like, I think people think, oh, Toronto, lots of snow, where there is a lot of snow. But Toronto is also an incredibly multicultural city. You know, it's maybe more multicultural, more diverse than Queens, New York, home of Hannah Rosen. But, you know, and yet we act like, and so it too contains multitudes, but we have a certain surface idea of it. Drake is Toronto.
I think that is in the bottom quintile of things I think about Drake. But I'm no Degrassi fan, I will admit.
No, but I know what June's getting at. Like, it's hard to think of a Canadian as street, you know? Like, even though you could be a street Canadian, it's just hard to, like, square those two things in your head.
And that's what's kind of endearing about him trying to make Toronto, like, the rap city of the moment, right? Like, it's not in any kind of East Coast, West Coast. Like, there's no specificity in Americans' minds about Toronto, like June was saying. And he's like, all right, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make it the center of hip-hop culture, which to us, we're like, that's cute. Like,
you're cute. Yeah, but he did kind of, but it's more than cute. Like, he did kind of pull it off. I'm not going to go deep into the rap beef that he has with Meek Mill, even though I know June especially is very interested in
rap.
Well, but it does.
But it does say something, because Meek Mill is like rapper as I understood rapper most of my young life when I listened to rap. And like, Meek Mill came in and he is from the streets. Like, he is from South Philly. And like, Drake just ran circles around him. And you ended up that whole beef thinking, wow, Meek Mill just stepped out of 1998, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like Nicki Minaj's boyfriend. Well, he's like a legit person. But he just like, and you're like, wait, he came from a different century. And it just made Drake, it just like Drake kind of crushed him in that battle.
Totally.
You know? Using a lot of social media and like PowerPoints and stuff, you know?
But
it made
but
you
then,
realize
but
how
you
much
know
stuff
what?
Has changed. Okay, so June, next week we'll do a new rap beef. Is that good?
That's great.
We'll do one every episode.
As long as they've been in a children's television show that I've watched, it's going to be fine.
Okay, excellent. Okay, let's do our recommendations. But before we do that, let's thank our third sponsor.
The XX Gabfest is also sponsored this week by Bowl & Branch. Now, I personally am one of the world's great sleepers. It's a talent that I've had since childhood, really. I've always been really in the top percentile of sleepers. And you know, there are a few things grimmer in life and just that set you up for failure and aggravation than sleeping badly. And you know, one way to improve your sleep is to have really amazing sheets like the ones from Bowl & Branch. You can only get their sheets in one place. That's bowlandbranch.com, where you know you're paying for quality and not department store overhead. You're getting $1,000 sheets for just a couple of $100. Go online to Bowl, that's B-O-L-L, and branch.com, and they'll even let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. If you don't absolutely love them, you can send them back, and you have nothing to lose. It gets even better. Go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. Sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, everything, plus free shipping. And all their products come beautifully packaged in their signature boxes. So go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order and use promo code XX. Bowlandbranch.com, promo code XX.
All right, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I have been reading a book called Mrs. Bridge, which is sort of like famous in certain circles, mid-century book by Evan Connell. And it's about a Kansas City matron who is sort of the country club set and concerned with propriety. And it's so dark and funny. They're very, very short chapters, and each of them essentially has a punchline where Mrs. Bridge is sort of pushing up against propriety in her own self, and propriety always wins. And that's sort of the joke. And it's just really good. And there's a Mr. Bridge version that's written from the point of view of her husband, who's like barely a character in this. And I can't wait to read that next.
Okay, me. I really, all I've been doing is watching The Girlfriend Experience, but I can't recommend that because Noreen did last week. So I'm going to recommend the other only thing that I've been watching, which is a few years old, but completely new to me and so bizarre, which is Green Porno. Do you guys know this?
No.
Oh my God, it's so weird.
Is that the thing from Thingies?
No, Isabella Rossellini?
Isabella Rossellini?
Yes.
I've
yes.
heard of it.
Oh my God. It is insane. It is so insane. It's basically her dressed up as different animals doing a radical feminist reinterpretation of animal mating habits. And she actually like reenacts their mating, but does it in a way which makes mating seem like a female dominated enterprise. You know, like she chooses the animals who, like, if they have too many babies to take care of, they kill some of the babies. Or like, you know, she talks about the female praying mantis. Well, she has the strongest sex drive. And she's totally earnest, and she totally reenacts the actual act of mating. It's kind of totally, totally amazing. I mean, I love her. I have always loved her. So just to see her earnestly, like, and she dresses up like fully, like hats, like a children's play in these animal costumes. And then it's just like a badass feminist mating thing. It's so weird. People really should watch it. It's really fabulous.
Where can they find it?
Green Porno, you just look up, it's like, I think it was the Sundance thing, they just put it online. So you just Google Green Porno and you get a few of the videos for free. They're so weird. They're each like a minute and a half or 2 minutes. I've been using them as like breaks between writing. They're really great.
Cool.
Anyway, June, your turn.
So my endorsement, since we've been talking about a Canadian phenomenon, is another Canadian phenomenon. It's a fantastic television show from Canada, which just showed up on Hulu. It's called Being Erica. And it's a really interesting, strange drama about a woman who finds a way to essentially go back in time to other parts of her life and learn about herself. It's a kind of a form of therapy, is to sort of travel through time and space. And it's really well acted. It's really fascinating. And it's set in Toronto, so you get a little sense of that city. So Being Erica on Hulu. Watch it.
All right. Well, thank you all. Let's wrap up. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Dinerstein, to our producer, Anne Hepperman, the executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lichtai. Indy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our intern is Shiva Bayat. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. To find out more about this show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX. Comment or suggest new topics on our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, or you can email us, XXGabFest@slate.com. You can subscribe on iTunes and anywhere else where people listen to podcasts to let your friends know about it. For June and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen. Jumping, 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 jumping. Ain't nobody telling this ain't what they want me. You ain't really right at all, like who's just coming? Better, better, maybe I'll be really starting. Oh, really on the plug, really. Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.